What's your address here?
103 Chandler Street.
How long have you been living here?
In Tuskegee?
Mm-hmm.
Since 1923.
Okay, I'm just getting a voice test.
Mm-hmm.
This is Alphonso Smith for the Alabama Center of Higher Education, member school, Tuskegee Institute, interviewing today Mrs. Jessie P. Guzman. Our location is
103 Chandler Street.
Okay, 103 Chandler Street, Tuskegee Institute, Alabama. Today's date is December 11th, 1973. All right, now let's begin, Mrs. Guzman, by your giving me your full name, and if you don't mind, your date and place of birth.
My name is Jessie P. Parkhurst Guzman. I was born in Savannah, Georgia, on December 1st, 1898.
Parkhurst?
Yes.
Parkhurst. I assume that's a family name.
That's my family name, yes.
I see. That's all right. Okay, I've heard of the Savannah. No, I don't think I know. I'm from South Carolina.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, a little further up the coast.
Columbia. My mother is from South Carolina. She came from Charleston.
Well, I live in Georgetown, which is only 60 miles from there.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Well, I used to. That's
where I don't know very much about Charleston because I haven't been there since I was very small.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I still have relatives there.
Okay, how do you spell your middle name?
Parkhurst.
Okay. Now, would you give me a brief summary of your education?
Well, I finished the graded school department in Atlanta. Of Clark University, and I also finished high school at Clark University, and from there I went to Howard University and graduated in the Department of the College of Arts and Sciences.
Mm-hmm. What's your religious affiliation?
Methodist.
Okay. AME?
AME.
Okay. When did you first come to Tuskegee?
I came to Tuskegee in September of 1923.
What was the reason for coming here?
I came here to be assistant in research to the late Monroe Nathan Work, who was at the time director of the Department of Records and Research at Tuskegee Institute, and had been since 1908.
Mm-hmm. And what was
Well, Mr. Work was a friend of my family.
Mm-hmm.
He had formerly taught in Savannah, and Mrs. Work and my mother were very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was on a visit to our home in Montclair, New Jersey, he had moved there then. He was in need of an assistant, and I was in need of a job. So he asked me to come to work with him here.
I see.
That's how I came to Tuskegee.
You weren't married then?
I was not married then.
I see. Okay. What was the occupation of your parents?
My mother was a dressmaker and a homemaker, and my father had a business of his own. He operated a dairy in Savannah.
I see.
At the time, as far as I know, he was the only Negro dairyman in Savannah.
I see. Was when you were growing up in Savannah, could you tell any difference between you socially, between your family and the other Negroes in the community?
No. There seemed to have been no difference as far as social status. I mean, I didn't recognize any when I was a child. The thing is, I only stayed in Savannah until 1910,
mm-hmm.
and then I left Savannah and went to Atlanta
mm-hmm.
To live with my godparents. That's why I graduated from the graded school department of Clark,
uh-huh,
because that was located in Atlanta. And I did not complete the public schools course in Savannah.
Oh, I see. Well,
and the people in our community, all of them were, it seemed to me, just about on the same economic level.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know of any very poor people. I mean, they didn't have very much, but they weren't what you call poverty stricken.
I see.
And my parents, in fact, I don't think we thought, when I was a child, I didn't think in terms of social class at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just didn't. I don't know why, but I guess we were taught that.
Mm-hmm. Did you think in terms of Negro and white?
Oh, yes. We thought in terms of Negro and white.
Well, as you were growing up, could you see any particular racial discrimination?
Oh, yes. Yes. My first experience with the racial situation was from a neighboring child. She was a German child. She lived right across the street from us in Savannah. And I remembered for a long time, we played together. For a very long time, and we thought nothing of it. But I had a sister who was very fair. I mean, you couldn't tell her from white.
Mm-hmm.
So one day, I don't know how it occurred to this child to let me know that she knew I was colored, but she did.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said, "Well, Jesse, I can't play with you anymore because you are colored. But I can play with artists because she's white," which means that she really didn't know the difference in race as such. But
artist
just
was, your sister?
Was my sister.
Uh-huh. I see.
And mm-hmm. so she had been taught it, you see.
Right.
And that was really my first experience. And that was before I was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first time I remember encountering the race problem.
Mm-hmm. Were things any better in Atlanta than Savannah?
No. At the time, Atlanta was really a racial conscious city.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt the pressure of race more in Atlanta than I did in Savannah. Because, of course, Savannah was a smaller city.
Mm-hmm.
And The only other experience that I remember real well in Savannah was the fact that children sometimes had encounters when they went to school. You know, in a group of children, white children would pass a group of Negroes and begin calling names and so forth and so forth. But it wasn't a mean, nasty, hateful thing. But in Atlanta, it seems to me the atmosphere was entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I finished college at Howard, it was so bad that my godparents, with whom I was then living, decided to move from Atlanta. And that was in 1920.
Mm-hmm.
And they moved from Atlanta to New York and never came back.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you know if your parents were registered voters in Savannah?
I'm sure my father was. Mm-hmm. I never heard of my mother voting, but I'm pretty sure my father was.
Right. Uh-huh. I don't think at that time they had.
No, women, no, they didn't have. Right. No, I was thinking back now, they did not have a women's suffrage. That came much later. But I'm sure my father did.
Mm-hmm. Your godparents?
Yes. My godfather voted.
He was a red voter.
Yes,
in Atlanta.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, what was his occupation?
Well, he was a minister, a Methodist minister, of the Methodist Episcopal Church.
Mm-hmm.
And he had pastored churches in various parts of Georgia for a number of years. And then Bishop Thurkill of the Methodist Church knew of a vacancy or knew that a secretary was needed by the American Bible Society in New York, and to help distribute the Bibles in the nation. And so he recommended my godfather. Now, my godfather's name was the Reverend John Percy Ragg, W-R-A-G-G. He came originally from Charleston, too. He came from the same city that my mother did. And so Bishop Thurkill recommended my godfather to the American Bible Society. And he was made agency secretary for the colored people of the South. And he worked all over the South. Promoting Bibles, the sale of Bibles, mm-hmm. for the American Bible Society. And he had a depository, there was a depository in a part of our home, was set aside as a depository for the Bibles that were shipped from New York to our home. And so he was doing that when I went to live with them in 1910. And then in 1920, he got this opportunity to move, although they were well settled in Savannah. We lived just outside of the campus of Gammon Seminary and Clark University at that time, in what was then known as South Atlanta. So he got this opportunity, and we moved to New York, and his work was broadened so that he became agency secretary for the colored people of the United States, mm-hmm. and that was in 1920. And he was given four sub-secretaries to work with him, and they were located in four different regions of the United States. Mm-hmm. And he kept that work. I mean, he worked there until 1928. When he retired from the American Bible Society.
Mm-hmm. The schools that you went to, were they segregated or integrated?
In Savannah, of course, they were segregated. Mm-hmm. In Atlanta, of course, Clark University was a Negro college, mm-hmm. Which had everything from the first grade up through college.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, though, when I first went there, they didn't have the kindergarten. Later, they got the kindergarten. And the Methodist Church had founded these Negro colleges for the Negroes as they came out of slavery as a part of their missionary work. And so Clark was segregated as to students, but it had a mixed faculty. The faculty was white and Negro, and that was true both of Gammon Seminary, because they had adjoining campuses,
right.
And it was true both of Clark University and of Gammon Seminary. And of course, associated with Clark was what was known as their home, a home where Negro girls were instructed in homemaking and the various aspects of homemaking by the Missionary Society of the Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that because of the segregated atmosphere, that in other words, the Negro students being sent to all Negro schools, do you feel that the quality of education was the same as it was in a white school?
Oh, no, nowhere. When I first went to Atlanta, there was no public high school. In 1910, there was no public high school. And when I left Savannah, there was no public high school for Negroes. And if parents wanted their children to go to high school, they had to send them either to a private school in Savannah, which was the Beach Institute, and or else to the high school departments of one of the Negro colleges. In Atlanta, there was Clark, Atlanta University, Marsh, Brown, and Morehouse. And of course, in other places, other high schools. But there must have been a high school department attached to Georgia State College then in Savannah.
Mm-hmm.
But, many of the students in Savannah went there. But many of the parents also sent their children away from home to high school. Because generally in the South, at that time, there were no public high schools.
A personal question here. What was the reason for your leaving Savannah to go to Atlanta to live with your godparents?
Well, my family was large.
Mm-hmm.
There were 8 children and a niece. There were really 9 children because I had a half-sister. My father had been married before.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother and father were both good Methodists.
Mm-hmm.
And the pastor of the Methodist Church in Savannah was the Reverend John and Percy Ragg and Mrs. Ragg.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother and father became very good friends with them. So while they were in Savannah, they told my mother that the next child they had, she had, that they wanted it named for them.
Uh-huh.
So I happened to be that child.
Mm-hmm.
And I became their godchild. And they never had any children of their own. So later on, as I said, in 1910, they ran across another friend of ours and asked this lady, who was then my sister's godmother, about me. And so she told them. And they wrote my mother and told them, and Paula, and told them that they would like to have me come and live with them if it was agreeable with them,
mm-hmm.
and to educate me and so forth. And so they asked me if I wanted to go. I was a little child, so I wanted to go.
Right, I understand.
I'm surprised now that I really, with such a large family, wanted to leave home. But I did, and so from then on, except for an annual visit home,
mm-hmm.
I lived with my godparents.
I see. Now, when you came to Tuskegee, what was the job description?
Uh-huh. When I came here, Mr. Work was then working on there were two things that he was working on. He issued periodically the Negro Yearbook.
Uh-huh.
And that was one thing I came to help with.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other thing he was working on was his bibliography of the Negro in Africa and America.
Mm-hmm.
And he had he had been working on it for quite a long time, compiling information for it. And he was to the point then when he needed someone to really do serious work on the compilation of materials. And so that's why I came, to help him, assist him with the bibliography of the Negro in Africa and America and on the Negro Yearbook.
Who was president when you came here?
Dr. Moulton. Dr. R. R. Moulton.
Okay. And did you have much contact with him?
With Dr. Moulton?
Mm-hmm.
Well, not too much personal contact, I mean as such, because I was young then.
Mm-hmm.
And we all looked up to Dr. Moulton. I mean, you of course, as far as students are concerned, I think maybe the attitude of the students to administrators may be different. But we had contact when we passed, you know,
mm-hmm.
and so forth, when we went to his office or something. But I didn't have too much, except occasionally on Christmas when he had Christmas parties for the faculty and staff. We would meet and that sort of thing, but I didn't have any very personal contact with Dr.
What kind of man did he impress you as being?
Well, he was a very dominant, he had a very dominant personality.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you just automatically respected him. I mean, there was no... You never thought in terms of not giving him, due respect,
mm-hmm.
The president of a Tuskegee Institute. And I don't know whether you have been informed or not about this practice, but whenever he entered the chapel on Sunday night, all students rose to greet him. Whenever he came in the chapel, every student in the chapel rose to greet him.
Mm-hmm.
And that practice, I understand, grew out of the fact that before Dr. Moulton's time, Dr. Washington had some difficulty in New York City with a white person who attacked him.
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots of stories about why he was attacked and the reasons for the attack. Well, anyway, the people in Tuskegee didn't believe any of it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Dr. Washington gave explanation of why he was in this particular section of New York. He was up there trying to get funds for Tuskegee Institute. Well, anyway, when he came home and first appeared in chapel. After that event, everybody in chapel rose to a man. No one told them to rise. And ever after that, whenever he came in chapel, that's what the students did.
I see.
And that practice ran through all through Dr. Moulton's administration until Dr. Patterson became president, and then he discontinued it. But it was a show of respect for the head of the institution.
Something new? Oh, incidentally, while I'm talking to you, right now I'm concentrating on the Civic Association, but we're also, this is for a class, and I'm being considered to be hired to work with this program and do some work for Joellen Price. And she is working on a total history of Tuskegee, which has never been done before.
That's right.
And it just occurred to me that you would be a brilliant source of information. And I'd like to tell you right now that I'm going to come back to you, because I see right now that you have got plenty of information.
No, I don't have all that information, but I have been around a long time.
Oh, yes. That's the same thing. I talked to Mrs. Kelly, and she told me she didn't know anything either. See, but I found out different. You telling me now? You telling me? I half of this stuff I didn't know in the first place. Okay. Now, let's. When did you first come to find out about the Tuskegee Civic Association or the Men's Club, as it was?
Well, I knew about the men's club before the Tuskegee Civic Association grew out of the men's club, because Mr. Work was a member, I believe, of the men's club.
Mm-hmm.
And if not a member of the men's club, he met with frequently with a group of men, I think very frequently, probably weekly.
Mm-hmm.
And they discussed problems, and not only did they discuss problems, but they also had a social hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the year, really, I don't. But I do know that the men's meeting came to me, a knowledge of the men's meeting came to me through Mr. Merck.
Did the women here at Tuskegee have any social outlet like that, you know?
Yes, the women, I think, had a much more rounded social life than the men had, because when I came to Tuskegee Institute, Mrs. Booker T. Washington was alive.
Mm-hmm.
And although about a little more than a year later, she died.
Mm-hmm.
But she had founded the Tuskegee Woman's Club, and it was really the center from the point of view of the community.
Mm-hmm.
The center of the life of Tuskegee's women.
Mm-hmm.
And this club met monthly, and Mrs. Washington always had a program as a part of the evening's procedure. And then, of course, there was a social hour, and once a year, the last meeting of the year, the women entertain the men of the community.
Mm-hmm.
But the Tuskegee Woman's Club was very powerful in those days. And if you were a woman and joined the faculty or staff of Tuskegee Institute, you automatically became a member of the Tuskegee Woman's Club. And Mrs. Washington would send around to collect your dues, which was $1 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was honored. I mean, we were really honored to become members of the organization, because she herself was a dominant personality too.
Mm-hmm. What type of activities did you have?
Well, we had, remember there were one of the part of the program that I remember definitely was a support for the Mount Meigs School for Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mount Meigs School for Girls. In fact, I believe it was the Tuskegee Woman's Club founded those institutions. I know that it did for the girls.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not quite so sure about the boys. But those two institutions, the Tuskegee Woman's Club, supported, and later the Mount Meigs Home for Boys and Girls was taken over as a project for the State Federation of Colored Women's Clubs, because this club here was associated with the State Federation. The State Federation was affiliated with the National Federation of Colored Women's Clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Washington was one of the founders of the Federation of Colored Women's Clubs.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in Tuskegee before you met Mr. Goodwin?
I think I met Mr. Guzman. I remember meeting him in 1927.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I remember meeting him.
Under what circumstances?
I don't remember. I will say this, that at that time, I think there was more sociability, perhaps, among all of the faculty of Tuskegee Institute. And usually, we all ate in the Institute's dining room. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you lived on the campus at that time, you had to eat in the dining hall furnished for teachers. And
was there any distinction between older instructors and younger instructors, or did you?
Oh yes. Oh yes, there was a distinction between the. I mean, the older members of the faculty had been here, of course, a long time.
Right.
They had known Booker T. Washington. Mm-hmm. They had grown up. Many of them had, had been here a long time. Had known him, and they all revered him. They just adored him. Mm-hmm. And when I came here, that's all I heard. That was 8 years after Booker Washington had died, and the whole place was still Booker T. Washington. Everybody was talking about what Mr. Washington said, what Mr. Washington did, what Mr. Washington would like to have had. Uh-huh. And I mean, the whole place was just Dr. Washington, really.
Do you feel that this was one of the reasons why Dr. Moton had to have such a dominant personality?
No, not at all. I mean, he had that before he came to Tuskegee. Mm-hmm. But you see, Dr. Moton was here because Dr. Washington wanted him to be here. He was really designated as his successor. Dr. Washington really designated Dr. Moton as his successor. And for that reason, quite a few of the people, men, who had been here, several men, I understand, mm-hmm. who had been here for some time, felt that, and had been very close to Booker Washington, at least I know one did, felt that they should have been the successors to Dr. Washington because they had experienced very close relationships with him. And one man that I know left the Institute and went elsewhere to work because he felt that he should have been there.
Was there much of this animosity against Dr. Moton?
As far as I know, there was no animosity. I mean, except, this person, I think, left before I came here. Mm-hmm. I don't mind saying who it was, Emma J. Scott, who had been Dr. Washington's secretary and had been very close to him and had done a great deal for Tuskegee Institute. He left and went to Howard University and was there, of course, a long time.
Right. Mm-hmm. But you don't know of any people who actively worked against Dr. Moton because they felt that, he was not...
No, I don't know of any. But you see, at that time, I wasn't in an inner circle as such, mm-hmm. because
right.
I was young, hadn't been here very long. I stayed a long time. Dr. Moton left in 35, and
right.
I came in 23.
Mm-hmm.
But between those years, I don't know of any inner group that worked against Dr. Moulton. Now, whatever criticism came about concerning Dr. Moulton was from the outside. And from people who had worked against Dr. Washington, because, you know, Dr. Washington had a lot of enemies on the outside of things too. So, and even today, this tradition of a certain amount of animosity toward Tuskegee Institute by certain groups and certain persons who have been the recipients of the other tradition as against the Tuskegee tradition, still have that feeling, you know, toward Tuskegee Institute. But as far as I know, within the Institute, there was no animosity. Although, as I say, I may not have known about it, but as far as I know.
In your position in research and records, did you have much opportunity to come into contact with the whites of Tuskegee?
No, I stayed clear of the whites of Tuskegee because knowing their attitudes, they didn't want to have anything to do with Negroes as such. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to have anything to do with them any more than they wanted to have association with me. I stayed clear of the people in Tuskegee, except where I had to. And one of the things I had to do was to have my teeth repaired. Mm-hmm. And there was a white dentist in the town. And so many of us had to go to this white dentist because at the time there was no Negro dentist. There had been one, but he had died. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I wanted to become a registered voter, I had to have a white person to sponsor my application. I went to this dentist and asked him if he would vouch for me, and he said no, he wouldn't. And so that was the end of him and me. I never went back to him anymore. And thereafter, I saved my dental work until I went to New York and had it done when I went home.
Do you remember what year you went to him to get him to vouch for you?
It must have been either 35 or 36. I don't remember year it was.
Now, who was the dentist's name? Let's fix him in history right now.
Let me see. Who was that dentist downtown? I've forgotten the dentist's name, really. I mean, that's how really, I just wiped him out of my I wiped him out of my memory, but I probably will remember it sometime and give it to you.
Okay.
But right now I can't remember what his name was.
All right, no.
But he did. He was the dentist of many of the colored people in this area.
Mm-hmm. What was your purpose for wanting to get registered to vote?
Well, I was a registered voter before I came to Tuskegee.
Mm-hmm.
First registered to vote. We moved out of New York. My godparents moved out of New York to, they never really lived in New York, only for a short time. They moved to Montclair, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
My godfather commuted from his home in Montclair, New Jersey to his office in New York at the Bible Society house in New York. And when I became 21, I was over 21 because I had already finished from college. But as soon as we met residence requirements, I assumed there, he took me to the registration our office and registered me to vote in Montclair, New Jersey. And I remember the registrar saying, so you aren't old enough to vote. I probably looked younger than I was. Mm-hmm. And so my godfather said, yes, sir, she's 21. So I had already registered to vote. So when I came down here, for a long time I didn't bother. But then people began, I really don't remember who started it, but the movement for registration of more Negroes began, and so we decided we were going to register to vote. And that's when I was first refused.
Here in Tuskegee.
Here in Tuskegee. Mm-hmm. And then later, and that was in 36, I decided I was going to try again to get registered. So I, at that time, Mr. Goodman and I were going together, and so he said, well, I'll tell you, there's a man downtown who fixes my car, so I'm going to ask him if he will vouch for you. That was the next year, I think. Must have been the next year, because I did get my certificate in 1936. So he went to the garage and asked this repairman, white repairman, if he would vouch for me. And he walked with us over to the courthouse and vouched for me. He had never seen me. I had never seen him. Mm-hmm. I don't know his name. I have never seen him since that time. But that man, who had never seen me, vouched for me. And the dentist that I had been going to for years would not. Heard. It was Dr. Heard.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think his name was Dr. C.H. Heard. I'm not sure now. But there is a question about the initials. But I know his name was Dr. Heard.
I can find out the initials. Yeah. I've got the name now. We just fixed him historically. Okay. Were there many women in Tuskegee who were registered voters?
No. No, there weren't many. The first time I counted, I just went through there, and I don't remember what year it was that I counted, really went through the list of voters in the Tuskegee News and counted them. And that year, there were only 150 Negroes registered in Tuskegee. I mean, I actually counted them, and I don't know what year it was, but it was, you know, a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Mr. Burke was one of the registered voters. I remember that. And there were only 150 the first time I counted them.
Okay. And you came to Tuskegee in 26?
No, I came in 23.
23. And when did Mr. Work leave?
Mr. Work died in 1945.
He was still here at Tuskegee then?
Yes.
Okay, in 45?
He died in 45.
So it was between 1923 and 1945.
Oh, yes. I mean, you mean as far as counting the votes?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I'm going to narrow it down even more after a while. Okay. Now, when did you first become interested in joining or working with the Tuskegee Civic Association?
Well, ever since I first went to live with my godparents, I knew about the NAACP because my godfather had known Dr. Du Bois when he worked in Atlanta at AU, his first time working at Atlanta. And then when he left Atlanta and went to New York to work at the headquarters for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, we used to get the Crisis magazine.
Right.
And my godfather also got for me the Child's magazine. They had published then a little magazine for children. the NAACP did. Mm-hmm. So very early, I knew about the NAACP, and my godfather and quite a number of the men around there used to talk about the race problem, you know, and discuss it. Mm-hmm. And there was a professor on the campus of Tuskegee Institute, Dr. William Henry Krogman, who was Latin and Greek teacher at Clark. And he, every evening, every afternoon rather, he came by our house. He and my godfather, when they were through with their work, they would sit on our front porch and talk about everything. Mm-hmm. And so I early became aware of the problems of Negroes. You know.
What?
Oh, and I, as I was saying, then, I mean, that kind of thing. And then when I went to Howard University, mm-hmm. I took a course on the Negro mm-hmm. under Kelly Miller, who was then dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. And that was really the first time that I had been introduced to the Negro as a real big problem. Mm-hmm. And I remember the book that I was assigned to review, one of the books, was Hoffman's Race, Traits and Tendencies of the Negro. And it's a vicious book. And an old vicious book. And from that time on, I think my interest in the problems of the Negro as a scientific problem to be studied and to work in eliminating the ideas, false ideas that people had concerning the Negro arose.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that in many instances you are able to dispel these ideas that whites have about blacks?
No, I don't think you really dispel them. I really don't. Mm-hmm. I think there are some people who are broad and generous in their attitude toward other people. But I'm sorry to say, fundamentally, I am the majority of whites, I think, still carry this idea that Negroes are really inferior people. I mean, I really believe that.
As a historian, I am not allowed to say whether I agree or disagree with you.
Well, as a historian, I don't mind saying it, because see, I'm retired, so I don't have anywhere to go. I have already reached where I'm going.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, okay. Now, when did you first become a member of the Civic Association?
I know it was probably shortly after it was organized, but I really don't remember the year.
When it was the Civic Association at the time?
Yeah, it was the Tuskegee Civic Association at the time, yes.
Oh, well, were there any other female members when you joined?
Oh, yes, uh-huh.
Okay, well,
yes.
I know when they changed the name, and I know when they opened it for female membership, so it yes. had to be a short time after that,
yes, but okay. Just when I mean, I really cannot say.
What work were they engaged in at the time when you joined?
At the time when I joined, I was really just a member mm-hmm. as such, and I just went to these Sunday meetings. The meetings on Sunday. Mm-hmm. Where they had speakers on various topics relating to to Negro life and the civic problems of Negroes. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until really much later than that I really became, you know, involved in its work, you know, as a really conscious participant, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I participated, but I wasn't one of the persons who was out front.
Mm-hmm. What brought about this consciousness?
I mean, as far as the civic association mm-hmm. is concerned. Well, I really can't put my hand on anything, but I think it was after I was in the Department of Records and Research from 1923 until 1938. Mm-hmm. Then I left the Department of Records and Research and became Dean of Women for 6 years. There was a period there of an interval of 6 years. Then I went back to the Department of Records and Research as director, mm-hmm. and that was in 1944. And it was then that really, about that time, really about 1944, that I became, as I recall now, really active in both the work of the NAACP and of the Tuskegee Civic Association. And I think when I went back, I was seriously involved with both organizations. But before that time, as Dita Woman, I didn't bother too much because I had my hands full, you know. Mm-hmm. I was teaching and at the same time was Dean of Women, so I just had just all I could do. But when I went over to Records and Research and became director over there, dealing with materials on the Negro, dealing with the lynching letter that Tuskegee Institute published annually, right. And compiling lynching records mm-hmm. and all of that, I think I really became involved as such with them. And then two, from time to time the Dr. Chameleon would ask me to appear on the program because I had lots of material at my disposal, right. And sometimes I would appear on the Sunday afternoon programs and things like that.
Were you ever a member? Were you ever an officer?
I've been on the board.
The executive?
On the executive board. Uh-huh. On the executive cabinet. Mm-hmm. But I have never been an officer. No secretary or treasurer or any that sort of thing. But I was on the, have been on the board. Mm-hmm. And then, in 1954, before the Tuskegee Civic Association took over the voter registration work in the county, mm-hmm. Previously it had been operated under the auspices of the NAACP,
right.
And later taken over by the Tuskegee Civic Association. And there was no political organization for Negroes in the county then. So the Tuskegee Institute was the organization through which the political aspects of the community were operated. But in 1954, the TCA decided that someone should become a member of the Macon County Board of Education, and somebody should run for office. So they asked me to run for the Board of Education. So it was the first time that any Negro had run for office for a long time. And that was under the auspices then of the TCA.
Mm-hmm. Did you
run? No. We only had at that time about, I think 900 votes. I think at that time we only had about 900 votes.
Mm-hmm.
But practically all of the Negroes. No, I don't believe we had 900 votes. I believe it was about 700 votes. Mm-hmm. And practically all of the Negroes did vote for me. But you see, I needed, they didn't have enough votes to elect anybody. But I think it was just a signal to the white community that Negroes were serious about participating in their own government. And that from then on, they were going to offer people as candidates for political office.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the gerrymandering conspiracy.
Well, that's really a long, long story, really.
Okay, well, the tape is getting short.
That's a lot. I'm sure I know Dr. Dominion told you about that gerrymander.
I've heard it many times. What I'd really like to know is what was your reaction when you found out that the Negroes had been gerrymandered out of the city?
Well, we all knew it was a tactic to keep Negroes from getting control mm-hmm. of the political situation because there were so many more Negroes than whites. Mm-hmm. And the whites knew if Negroes ever got in control, that would be probably the end of them. Mm-hmm. Although Negroes didn't want it that way. I mean, what they really wanted was to be included in the government, not to take over the government. But you see, they didn't see it that way. They felt that they didn't want Negroes to have anything to do with the government. That's right. All. Mm-hmm. So we were all you all of the opinion that we should do something about it. And I think that fact, that the business of throwing Negroes out of the city was probably the incident that unified the Negroes more than anything ever, mm-hmm. unified Negroes in the whole community.
What was the reaction of the Negroes to the boycotting of the white businesses in the city?
Well, generally, they supported it. Mm-hmm. There were a few who didn't. And they gave for their reason the fact that in the white stores, the goods, food, and so forth, were cheaper. And then some of them, you know, they just didn't want to be bothered with that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They had never been concerned too much. But as a whole, the community was behind it.
The whites,
well, you know, I guess you have heard what they did. The governor, not the governor, the attorney general, mm-hmm. and
Patterson.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Attorney General Patterson, and his assistant, and as representatives of the state, of course, tried through the courts to stop the boycott. You know that, mm-hmm.
right.
And of course, the court ruled against them,
mm-hmm.
Saying that anybody has a right to trade or not to trade wherever they wanted
to. Did you have to testify in that?
No, I didn't have to testify. Mm. But I heard much of the testimony. I was there in court when mm-hmm. when the testimony was given. And the Negroes there, this just showed up the, they made those, the white people look very, very stupid.
It seems to me that you just don't have any extra love in your heart for white folks. It seems that way.
I'm sorry that I come through like that. I'm really sorry. But there are some white people that I'm very fond of.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they're, as they say about Negroes, they are individual Negroes that I like. Or they are individual white people that I like and like very much.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have some very good white friends.
What was the attitude of most of the people towards Dr. Chameleon as a leader?
Well, generally, they thought of him as a well-qualified person,
mm-hmm.
A very capable person, a very industrious person.